As we were talking earlier to a few individuals, we said, well, maybe it'd be helpful just to start off with a kind of a checklist of just some common things of ways of just beginning to ascertain if indeed I may have a little bit of an eating disorder to begin with. Not that there are degrees, but anyway, looking at just a few statistics, according to one source that I've read, there's approximately 80,000 cases reported nationally, which means if you're familiar with some of the average percentages, is a very low percentage of actual cases. And one of the things that I've realized, at least at the University of Oklahoma, is that as you get into a women's dorm floor, begin helping some individuals there, as you get into some of the sororities, a number of different cases, that many of the cases are not reported. And so it is, I believe, something of a great proportion in our society. It's really happening. And when you include in the eating disorders, the anorexia, the bulimia, and the compulsive overeating, you're looking at a pretty vast amount of the individuals. And so you're looking at basically a compulsive behavior pattern that really afflicts quite a large percentage of the population. 90% of the cases then that were reported, at least, were female, generally occurring at puberty. It's about 90% of the reported cases. And I've had a few cases of male, and specifically anorexic with that. I haven't seen a lot of male bulimia, personally, but I've seen male anorexic. Anorexia has approximately a 22% mortality rate. So those that have that particular eating disorder, one out of five basically die from it. 50% female plus females have been on a reducing diet during adolescence if they have some kind of eating disorder. So there's seems to be a real emphasis on diet, and tends to get individual focusing then on the various food things, and basically on body shape and size, and maintaining that and controlling that. For every one anorexic, there are 12 bulimics. So if you look at the 80,000 cases that were reported were the more severe ones, which tends to be the anorexic, then you can really blow that up significantly. And then 60%, I found this kind of interesting statistic, approximately 60% of all models and dancers have eating disorders. So whether it's really highly structured on maintaining a particular body size and shape, especially, maybe in cases where individuals have very low metabolism, where food seems to be a moment on the lips and forever on the hips, if you will, in that kind of a case, then they really tend to really slip over into the compulsive type of behavior. So for some of the description then and development of that, I just want you to take out the yellow sheet, and I know you can read, but these are pretty descriptive of ways of assessing. What do many people often look to as far as symptomatics of these things? Looking at anorexia nervosa, literally the word anorexia nervosa means as a nervous lack of appetite. That's what it means, but it's really a misnomer. But it's been labeled that way, and it's been tagged that way. And so, but it's characterized by weight and food preoccupation and an intense desire to be thin. And that specific one. And we're going to look at some of the reasons for that in a little while. But on your sheet, turn with me, anorexia, here are some common things that both counselors and various individuals can look at to see and ascertain if this may be a problem in their life. Number one, for women, you have irregular periods, or have you experienced total loss of menstruation for at least 3 cycles when it should otherwise have been expected. In other words, you're not pregnant, but your menstrual cycle has stopped. And when that is indeed the case, many times your body, of course, is saying something. It's not getting enough energy to take you through a normal cyclic phase. One individual that I counseled up in Nebraska was, she began noticing from the roof of her mouth, because of a lack of nutrition, the roof of her mouth began peeling away. She just wasn't eating enough to maintain, you know. And she was actually having almost a scurvy-like reaction, the lack of vitamin C. Second thing, have you been dieting? Not because you're overweight, according to standards based on your age, sex, and height, but because you desire to be more slim in your appearance. And again, another individual I was sharing with, and we were talking about this issue, said that they didn't realize they had a problem, except their clothes kept getting bigger and bigger, and then one day they were all going to the beach and had driven all the way down to Florida with her family, and when she got in her bathing suit, everybody was appalled. And she had not really realized what had happened. She did realize it, but she hadn't seen it from their perspective, from their eyes. And so she was trying to be more and more slim, even though it was not necessarily according to the standards of age and sex and height was appropriate. You claim to feel fat while others tell you that you obviously are not overweight. And, you know, many times people try to deal with an anorexic as saying, well, you know, you look fine. But they're appealing to the rational. But there's nothing rational about it. It's more of an emotional issue. And so they feel fat. And it's an emotional feeling. When others tell you that you are not overweight, do you ever feel annoyed or irritated? Perceiving that they are trying to control your body, that they're jealous, or they just cannot understand the needs of your life and your body? Okay, the fifth thing, do you often think about food, calories, body weight, nutrition, and cooking to the extent that thinking distracts you from other important, though unrelated, responsibilities and tasks? So basically, all that's saying is food becomes the emphasis of everything. Well, what are we going to have to eat tonight? You're thinking about that at breakfast and various different things. Does physical exercise occupy a disproportionate amount of your time each day? Again, one individual I was counseling with that said, you know, I've really kicked the eating disorder habit. And I said, well, okay. And, you know, I was looking at her, though, and it didn't look like she had kicked the eating disorder habit. And so I began asking her some questions. And she said, well, you know, I jog about 4 or 5 miles a day. And I said, oh, really? And she said, yeah, you know, and I've really got a problem because I'm just getting tireder and tireder and tireder. I said, do you do that every day? And she goes, yeah, every day. But she had gotten into physical exercise to try to take up the slack for what she was eating. She was trying to run out, if you will. Do you weigh yourself frequently, even going out of your way in order to get a set of scales and check your weight one more time during the day? Do you fast, induce vomiting, use laxative or diuretics in order to lose weight? Do you go to the bathroom immediately after meals? Or do you get angry or irritated if it is occupied or you must delay for some other reason? You often hide and hoard food or act out some other type of food-related behavior which you think is sensible, but which you prefer others to not know about. You know, and that's a real secretive element that we'll examine in a minute. You feel nauseated or bloated when you eat as much or as less than others your own age and size at a normal mealtime without prior snacking. Okay? And do you occasionally binge on food and feel ashamed of yourself and atone for your overeating by subsequently starving yourself totally for a period of time? So you eat one day, starve 3 days. Eat one day, starve 3 days. That's very typical. Now just turn totally over, clear to the back. There's compulsive overeating and then there's bulimia nervosa. Bulimia nervosa actually literally means ox hunger, ox, O-X. Like you eat like an ox. But that's how they dubbed that term. Are you fearful of being fat, believing that body fat is a sin, or is it wrong to be fat? You try to diet repeatedly only to sabotage your plans by binging activities for which you feel great shame. Again, that's the secretive type of a thing. You frequently tend to overestimate your needs for food intake for a given meal or snack, especially over-snacking when under stress, which is an interesting thing. When the stress comes on, when it's during test time and so forth and so on, it's and as a person, I think, in a sense, as their insecurity rises many times, they'll go to that secure thing, that food, and eat it. You hide and hoard private stashes of food for later binging. You binge on high-calorie, sugary, forbidden foods or on safe foods, such as salads. You shroud your eating. So Well, that his, I was just going to point this out. One bulimic that I was counseling with said, wouldn't eat salad, period. And she told me, the reason I don't eat salad is because it gives me this full feeling. And so I'd rather, you know, snack on things like ice cream and, you know, other things. But they would never eat salad because it made them feel too full. And they didn't like that feeling whatsoever. Do you shroud your eating, especially binges, in secrecy, fearing anyone's scrutiny of your eating behavior? Do you often feel ashamed or depressed when you eat? Do you spend much time thinking about your next binge, planning it, perhaps in detail, when you should be engaged in other tasks and activities? Or, along with that, do thoughts about food occupy much of your time? Does any interruption of this thinking result in your feeling cross, irritable, and angry, all of which you must hide from anybody else's notice? Do you induce vomiting in order to get rid of the binge food? Do you exercise or work to work off a binge? Do you use laxatives or diuretics in a way that's then prescribed to eliminate food you've eaten? And by the way, diuretics, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but that's something that gets the kidneys working, and so it takes off excess water. Do you also engage in any of these behaviors, especially to discharge feelings of anger or anxiety, which may have accompanied the binge? And so many times, if you look at a bulimic episode, or even anorexia for that matter, you'll find that it's generally caused by something. There's some incident or circumstance in a person's life that either made them feel out of control, angry, insecure, something like that. You disappear to the bathroom or to another available hidden source of plumbing immediately after meals. You become anxious or angry if it is occupied. You cannot use it for any other reason. You've been living in a college dorm room with a sink or other source of plumbing. Have you ever had the maintenance calls to repair the plumbing system due to your purchase? In other words, it becomes full and you get stopped up. Do you binge purge more than 3 times a week? And have you been confronted by others about your behavior and denied all, and then resolved to start keeping more distance from friends and family members to avoid future confrontations about food behavior? The day I came here on Tuesday, that morning it was a call from a sorority. I got a call from a young sorority lady who was in charge. I don't know what exactly. She was kind of the, I don't know if it was the sorority chaplain or something. I mean, it had something to do with she was in charge of helping people with problems in her sorority. And that, at least that's how she described it to me. And then this was one of the rush problems that they were having, is the number of individuals coming in and were having these problems that they were rushing and began realizing that you really had a serious problem with this. And they wanted some help to know what to do with it. Then when they confronted and said to the individual, can we help? You know, can we really help you through this? You're still accepted into the sorority. Everything's cool. Can we help you? Then the gal just exploded. And so she wanted to know, what do I do now? You know, what do I do now? But she just exploded and shut off. You know, she just got so angry that she was even confronted with it. And so, I cautioned her to be careful that she doesn't pull away. You know, try to maintain some kind of relationship with them so you can be there. Okay, then the other one, compulsive eating. And this one, many times people don't necessarily consider this as a problem. I mean, it is definitely a problem. And when you begin looking at diet centers and so forth and so on, and how much that industry is producing every year, you know that it's becoming quite an obsession with our culture. Are you overweight despite prompting to lose weight by others, including a physician? Have you repeatedly attempted to diet only to fail or sabotage your weight loss? Do you overeat by binging or grazing? I like that term, grazing. Snacking constantly, usually while engaging in other activities. And that grazing, by the way, is kind of just this mindless thing. You know, you're watching the television tube. I've done this, you know, and you're watching a television or you're talking to somebody. And then you look down and you think, what happened, you know, to that bag of popcorn? It's gone, you know, and you were the only one snacking on it. So you realize that, you know, that you're grazing. That's the kind of grazing it's talking about there. Do you keep private stashes of snacks, hoping to ensure that others will not know or discover them? And you'll see that a lot of these are familiar across all three. Do you make a lot of self-demeaning or insulting jokes about your food consumption or body weight? Do you go some trouble to eat alone in secrecy? Is your food your friend? Do you have urges to eat when you're feeling sad, angry, afraid, anxious, or ashamed, or when you're experiencing other unwelcome emotions? As you eat at such times, do you ever think, I deserve this? That's been amazing for me, especially, is that, it's interesting that basically the way I was raised is if you're, when you celebrate, and I think this is true of a lot of people, when you celebrate, you eat. But when you get sad, guess what you do? You eat. When you're sad, your girlfriend breaks up with you or something like that. My mother used to come and bring a nice, fresh pan of cinnamon rolls, as if, would I rather have a girlfriend or cinnamon rolls? Let's see, now what's the question again? And so she would try to make you feel better by doing something special, and that was just one way that they did that. So many times, so I found myself even emotionally being drawn towards the fridge during times of both sadness and gladness. Do you expend much mental energy thinking about food and eating, especially during times when your mind should be focused on the task at hand? Do you ever feel angry, which must be suppressed and denied so your feelings will not be known, when you are obstructed or interrupted in any way from eating, especially when you're alone? Does feeling ashamed of your body weight result in renewed eating binges and or grazing? Do you ever fear that you might be crazy because of the self-defeating behaviors that result from that? When you were a child, did have a cookie mean shut up? Or do you sense this or similar type of message when you ate, or when you eat now? You sense that. So those are some basic things to help you, and as you begin to assess just some of the characteristics of these of the eating disorders. Our great obsession with food is causing, I believe, some major problems. Now, there's some development things that begin to happen, and I want to basically talk about for a minute just some of the things of the compulsive overeating, since that's one we don't hear quite so much about. The compulsive overeating then is characterized. Okay, we talked about intake of large quantities of food, usually without purging of some sort. It resembles a bulimic-like binging or grazing. We talked about that. But compulsive, the first stage, I guess they've really broken this down into stages, and as you see it develop in a person's life. And the first stage of that syndrome involves eating for pleasurable reasons rather than for nutritional reasons. So you just like to eat, period. That's what I like to do. And many persons in our culture operate from this. So many compulsive overeaters eat when they're not hungry. Second stage, then, is characterized is when a person eats for emotional reasons. Now, this is of a compulsive overeater. So first they're eating for pleasure, and then they begin eating for emotional reasons. And they're happy, sad, bored, depressed, so forth and so on. And so it becomes kind of a surrogate mother, if you will, a surrogate that as I eat, then I feel comfort of some sort. And then the final stage in compulsive overeating is a person, basically, they lose control over food. They begin to abuse the refined carbohydrates, the sugars, the junk food, if you will, donuts, sweetbreads, cakes, sugar, chocolate types of things. And then, but in summary, eating disorders are a serious malady, and treatments must involve they must involve more than just the willpower. Many people say, well, if you find out you've got an eating disorder, why don't you just stop it? That's their answer, just stop it. Here, eat a little bit more. And really, I wish it was that simple, but it's not. We tend to see that research now indicates that disorders most likely result from a combination of four different areas. It could be more than four, but here are four basic areas. One's biological, one's psychological, the other's cultural, and the other's familial, which means it has to do with the family. Those things working in concert together, and ignoring any one of those areas is likely to make treatment ineffective in helping permanent changes, in helping people overcome those kinds of stuff. Now, here's some truths. As I've counseled, here's some basic things about eating disorders. And I know some of these are maybe new. But the first truth is that it takes more energy to not change than to change. In other words, it takes more energy to maintain your eating disorder than it would be to give it up. So when a person in their rational mind thinks, no, it takes more work to change than to not change, then they're kind of caught in a despair helplessness. And so one of the things you realize, it actually takes more energy to keep it up. To keep this secret lifestyle up, it takes more energy than just to let it go and relinquish it and begin working on those things. Now, many times it does not seem like it. And that's what I'm talking about. Rationally, we'll begin to really question that. Second thing would be it takes help and encouragement from others to change. I need other people. And that's where the secretive thing is. If it's such a, since it is such a secretive type of a thing where many people are ashamed of, you don't want other people in on it. The more people that get in on it, the more problems you have, or so you think. But the fact is we do need other people, and there are some reasons for that, which we'll talk about. Another thing I've run into, another truth, is my friends will care for me even if I don't have a problem. Now, some people get so hooked into an eating disorder and having one that their basic identity becomes wrapped up in it, and then they get all these paths, in a sense, they get all this attention from having it. So that becomes my glory, if you will. It's something that people, when they think of me, it says, oh yeah, it's the anorexic queen or something. You know, it's a real positive thing, but people are paying attention. And I'm different than other people, and that may be the one thing that I'm different from. So you've got to come to see that, you know, maybe my friends will care for me, even if I don't have this problem. Another thing is I can choose to stop this defeating lifestyle. That's the truth. I can choose to stop it. By the way, that's the definition of a compulsive behavior. A compulsive behavior comes when a person loses the ability to choose. If I say in my will, then, my volition, I cannot choose against it, guess what? You won't choose against it if you don't think you can. And so one of the things in a counseling process, you've got to reestablish a belief. Yes, I can choose against it. I can choose to stop this defeating lifestyle. A fifth one is I don't need an excuse to make mistakes and fail in life. I can be honest with that. And so it really has to do with the ability to deal with failure. I can fail. And so, I don't need an excuse necessarily to make those mistakes and to fail in life. I don't have to be perfect, in other words. And then sixth thing is I can choose against what I feel without damaging myself. And that's one of the things of the American culture, is that American culture judges most things by how they feel. It's not by what they think, but it's by what they feel. And so you can turn on the TV and you watch debates on television, whether they be political or whatever, or when, and you can sometimes tell when it's an emotional issue versus a rational issue, because sometimes the people make some of the most irrational comments. And it just shows you that's an emotional issue. It's a dealing with emotion. So that is one of our things. If I can choose against my feelings without denying it. Now, some people really say, no, you can't. You really can't choose against your emotions. But then I'd have to come back. And now, I don't know how it is today on college campus, but when I was on campus a long time ago, there were some mornings when I didn't want to get up and go to class. I mean, there really was. And I chose against my feelings. My feelings said, stay in bed. But I chose and went to class. And you know what? It did not damage me. In fact, it kind of helped my grades out just a little bit. So it is not, I can choose against my feelings, especially if the feelings are secondary, you know, they're basically caused from some irrational things. Okay. Eating disorder focuses. What are some things that people focus on in the EDs, the eating disorders? And one, of course, is food. It's the eating/not eating for acceptance, basically. Well, just the eating, not eating. And then on emotional thing, it's eating, not eating for acceptance. Their focus is then on their feelings and emotions. That's their standard of measure. If I feel good, don't feel good, whatever. There tends to be a focus on fatalism. It'll just happen again. It's hopeless. And that becomes an inappropriate focus. Another one is body, conformity. And they basically, conformity has to do with shape and size. And when a body conformity basically equals acceptance. And by the way, the culture really plays into this one. It really does. The extremes of this body conformity thing is sometimes with bulimics and anorexics, they do that to be accepted by other people. But some choose obesity, if you will, for protection. And so it's both extremes. Sometimes it's thinness to be accepted, but another one can be obesity for protection. Sometimes it can be thinness for protection, too. But what I basically mean by that is one young lady that I was counseling had an unfortunate experience in high school. And one day she was staying after school, and she was helping the teacher with some things. And the teacher took some inappropriate advances towards her. And, you know, we're all very aware of those kinds of things now on national TV and things. But anyway, this teacher made some inappropriate advances towards her, a high school girl, not overweight, just the right weight, and kissed her on the lips. Now, that was the incident, happened about, you know, took just seconds. Now, I was counseling with her 3 years later. She was between 75 to 100 pounds overweight. And since that time, she had just begun to stuff food in here. Well, as a result, she was that much overweight. What do you think it accomplished for her? Because she didn't have to worry about dating very much. And she didn't have to worry about that whole guy issue because, you know, she was making sure that she wouldn't have to. She was scared of it. And she had used it, and this was in her own words, she'd used it to protect herself from anybody trying to get close, because she was really scared of that. Because she was a very, very naive young lady in high school. Then another thing is habit, that I can actually choose against it. You know, and so that's where the compulsive behavior. So sometimes people focus on their habit. And by the way, if I were to say to you tonight, don't focus now. I don't want you to think about pink rabbits. And the first one of you that forgets and doesn't think about pink rabbits, raise your hand. See, nobody'd raise their hand. Because then the second I'd say, well, why are you raising your hands? And you said, because I'm not thinking about pink rabbits. And I said, well, how'd you know that? Oh, okay. Well, you know, you don't overcome something you're continually focused on. So many times there has to be a change of focus. So as you begin to focus more and more on your habit, there's a tendency for it to become worse and worse. And that's one of the things that I have in basically in a counseling situation. They say, well, I want to know, with this one young lady came in, I says, well, how often do you binge purge? I just talked to her, and she said, well, you know, right now it's about 5-6 times a week. You know, it's almost every day, but sometimes I have a day without. I said, okay. I said, tell you what, this week, here's your assignment for this week. I want you just to forget about binging and purging. In other words, what I mean is I just don't want you to think about it. If you want to do it, just go ahead and do it. Just do it. But here's what I want you to think about. You know, let's think about, you know, your grades, and you want to go on to be a counselor, and you want to go do these things, and I just want you to go ahead and think about it. Or, you know, just go ahead and just do it if your urge comes up. And then she sat back, and I was doing this for a reason. She sat back and said, I can't do that. I said, why not? She said, well, then I'll do it. And I said, well, what's the difference between how you're living your life now? I mean, you're doing it all the time now. So what's the difference? And she said, well, I don't know. And so as we, you know, and I gave her some other things to focus on, you know, not just that. It was very interesting what began to happen as you began seeing that compulsive behavior begin to slip away. She began refocusing on something else. And she wasn't continually, always, she wasn't in the forefront of her mind all the time. So, you know, there's caution with that. You don't just say, people, go ahead and do it all you want. But just what you're doing is refocusing it so it doesn't become the very center of your life. And then one is perfection. You know, a focus on perfection. I'm trying to create perfection in me and have absolute control. And then there's a secrecy. The focus is on secrecy to cover the shame of what's happening. I don't want anybody to know this. This is kind of something that I don't want. And then many times there can be focus on childhood memories, the very memories associated with it, these kinds of things. Now, here's something that counselor friend of mine in Dallas said something recently. She mainly counsels with women and a lot of women with eating disorders, and she said she's seen a high percentage, as high as 80-90+% of the women she counsels with eating disorders have also been sexually abused. Now, that was just in her counseling practice. So there is some kind of incident. So you may be dealing, sometimes the reason that a person doesn't overcome an eating disorder necessarily may be because there are some other complicating circumstances. And that's part of what we're talking about, the familial or the family type relationship. So here's some overall, the question many times comes is, where can an individual go for help that has an eating disorder? But before you answer that question, before I answer that question, I think you have to answer some other questions. Do I really need help? Do I really want help? You've got to answer that one first. And am I really ready to receive help? I had a young lady, sorority gal, come in, and she'd been actually kicked out of the sorority because she had an eating disorder. And they found out. They evidently had heard her purging, and they disciplined her in the house and kicked her out, which is, you know, that was really helpful for her eating disorder. It wasn't very helpful. I was being very facetious there. And so they kicked her out, and she was coming in to me for counseling. And she said, well, you know, and I asked her a question, well, had you been in therapy with this before? And she said, yeah, I have. And she said, by the way, she said, I went to counseling, and my father spent, and this is what she said, she saw a psychiatrist, and he spent $400 an hour for therapy for her. I said, oh, well, what did you learn? She said, well, I learned I did it for control, which, of course, you can kind of learn if you just pick up any book on eating disorder in about the first 5 minutes. And I said, okay, why'd you stop seeing him? You know, I figured, well, maybe it's too expensive. You know, I can give some reasons. But I said, why'd you stop seeing the guy? And she said, well, he was too direct with me. Too direct with you? I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. So the question is, are you really want help? Because she was seeking help, but she didn't want to receive help from this guy because he was being too honest with her and too direct. In other words, you're paying me $400 an hour. I'm gonna try to help you out here. I'm gonna ask you some hard questions. Let's get down to the root of this thing. And she really didn't want help at that point. So what if I know someone with eating disorder? One of the things you can do is you can volunteer to go with them or encourage them to get help. You can really encourage them in that way. They do need your help, and they do need your encouragement in that. But just be careful to not take on responsibility. You know, becoming a caretaker for them, if you will. That it's your responsibility for them to get help, and if they don't, they're going to die, and you know, all this kind of stuff. You can really work yourself into a frenzy with that. But you need to just be available to them. And remember this little axiom. If you try to help someone who doesn't want your help, then you need help. And so, you know, and sometimes a person comes in and they want you to help their friend, but they won't bring their friend in. I said, you know, that's kind of like doing dentistry. You know, if I'm going to work on your friend's teeth, I need them here to do that. So I can't do the, you know, that's called voodoo dentistry, and I can't do that. I can't do voodoo counseling either. You know, and people that are not here, not present here, you know, I can't help in that situation. I'm going to have Shelley come up, And she's going to share a little bit. She's struggled with bulimia, and she's going to come up and share a little bit about her struggle with bulimia.
Hi, I'm Shelley, and I'm bulimic. I was bulimic for 3.5 years through my junior and senior year in high school and into my freshman year in college and into the summer after my freshman year. My bulimia, or my eating disorder, started out first as over-exercising. It's another purging mechanism other than the vomiting, the over-exercising is, but I thought I was doing what society was telling me to do. I was exercising. I was in shape. I was doing it all the time, but I was in shape, so there was nothing wrong with it. Cheerleading trials were coming up, and I was in shape, but I had to be thinner. So the only way I was going to make the deadline for being thinner was to begin throwing up what I was eating. So that's when the vomiting started, the purging. And unfortunately, I didn't make cheerleader, and it was devastating. And it was... from that point on, I was like, I'm going to show them. In fact, I'm even going to be thinner. I'm going to be more than they ever thought I could be. And I was out to beat them. And I was going to be in control. My parents had gone through a divorce. I had taken care of the family. I was the caretaker. I took care of my mom. I kept the family together, kept everybody as happy as we could keep everybody. Had a boyfriend whose brother had been killed, so I carried him through that. So I was just caretaking everywhere. In a lot of leadership positions, a lot of things to live up to, and the only way I could keep my head above water was to binge and purge. It was the only way I could do it and live up to the expectations I felt like the high school had on me. And got out of high school, got up here at Tech, and I was like, I'm out of leadership. I'm not doing anything. I'm not going to have any expectations, and it's going to make this whole thing a whole lot better. And unfortunately, my freshman year, it became worse. And I had promised myself when I started this whole deal, it wasn't going to get out of control. I was going to be in control the entire time. You're out of control from the very beginning. It never gets out of control. It's out of control when it starts. And unfortunately, mine got worse and worse and worse. I had a point I was taking laxatives anywhere from 80 to 90 a day, and could not function, obviously, very well. And then my purging got to where it was every time I put a piece of food in my mouth, every time I saw a commercial with a skinny girl. And I finally said, I think this is out of control. I don't think this is right. There's something not right about this. And that's when I got help. When I originally went for help, I called out at Charter, and I was like, look, I'm bulimic. I just need to talk to somebody. And he convinced me to come in and talk to him, and I thought, once he gives me the Webster's Dictionary of Bulimia and scares the heck out of me, I'm going to be fine. I'm going to quit. And I went in that afternoon, cried my eyes out for 3 hours. It was very hard, but I thought, this is going to do it, because it was very devastating, very devastating. And I didn't realize that sexual abuse from when I was in second grade and sixth grade had anything to do with me at the age of 19 at that time. That just 80 million things came into play, that this was just a symptom of all that was going on inside of my life. And so after seeing him, they had told me, she said, you know, for as much as you're binging and purging, I will have to hospitalize you, otherwise I cannot treat you. And I was like, I'm not that out of control. I promised myself I would never get here, and I know I'm not there. This cannot be happening. And I went home, and the next day I binged and purged, and it was my head said no, and my hand reached for the food, and it was in my mouth, down my stomach, and back up. And it was that cycle all the time that drove me crazy, of my head going, Shelley, do not pick this piece of food up. Do not eat it. And there went my hand, and I could pick it up, and it'd go in my mouth. And it was crazy. It drove me nuts, and then I was throwing it up. And so I ended up binging and purging that day, and it was very obvious to me that day that it was out of control, and it was not something I could control. And I went home that weekend, told my parents. And fortunately, my mom, I was not going to tell them, and my mom found laxatives between my mattress. and not knowing anything was just like, what are these for? And, oh, I just rolled some story off, you know, top of my head. And she was like, oh, okay. And I was going, you believe me? You know, but I'd gotten so good at manipulating, so good at turning things around. And I finally sat down and told them that weekend what was going on. And a year ago, I went to treatment out here at Charter Plains. And I was out there for a month and a half. And I'm still dealing with every day, one meal at a time. And in the last 6 months, it's been through Jesus Christ that I've been able to realize that I am beautiful and I'm fearfully and wonderfully made by God. And that has saved me. But it's been tough, but I've gotten through it. And if there's any of you here that have an eating disorder, it's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. And it will take over and it will take control. And there's help out there.
Question often comes, how can she make such a statement that it's going to get worse and not better? Now, how can a person actually say that? I mean, she can say it from experience, but why is that actually true? And one of the things is that eating disorders have their basis mostly in emotional issues. If you stop and think about it for a minute, food is not emotional. Food is a body provision. It's a physical provision. If you want to consider just looking at our personality, some people call it the soul of the mind, will, and emotions. If I take a body provision to meet an emotional need, it should not work. It was never intended to work that way because food is impersonal. Well, how could food meet an emotional need? It's never designed to do that. And so as a result, when I go to food to meet an emotional need, it should make me angry. Now, wait a minute. Why isn't this working? It actually creates more anger, more frustration, because you're going to something to try to make it work. And what was interesting what Shelley shared is that you're out of control. And it's one of the major things with eating disorders is you know, people do it for control. They want control over their body size and shape. They want control over various different things. But when you get involved in it, you're doing it for control, but you get out of control. So that's the end result in it, is basically being out. So what types of emotional needs then do we, if it's an emotional thing, what types of emotional needs do people encounter? Or what are they? Well, one is that love and acceptance we talked about. And that's perhaps the most common. One of the most common ones, being love and acceptance, and basically the opposite of rejection. And individuals try to gain acceptance and approval through body conformity. In Shelley's case, I want to be a cheerleader. And so I'm going to do that, and maybe I'll be accepted and approved and to be able to do that. And of course, that's a cultural thing. And back in my time, there was a gal named Twiggy. I don't know what her real name was, but you know, that kind of became the in thing for a while, that, you know, everybody had to be a Twiggy type of figure, so forth and so on. Or perhaps you were raised in a home where food equals love. And see, I was raised on a little farm in northwest Iowa, and I really identify with this particular one myself. And on that farm, my parents weren't really that well-to-do, and so they were struggling and eking out a living, so as a result, there couldn't be, you know, mom, dad couldn't afford clothes or cars or, you know, those kinds of things. But one thing that mom could do was bake. And we had some dairy cattle and a few other things, and she could really take that cream and make butter and cook and do all that kind of stuff. And so that was the way that my mother showed love to us. And she said, you know, if you love me, you'll eat my cooking. And to this day, when I go home, it's like, okay, you know, have another piece of pie or do this or that. And, no thanks, Mom, I'm on Weight Watchers, you know, and that's not on my diet. Or, you know, whatever it is. And then she feels hurt because you didn't eat that extra food that she made just especially for you. types of things. So a lot of times there can be, that's the familial interaction. The family comes in and saying, you know, eat for love, eat for love. Second one is control. That's one of the major reasons that people eat, to try to gain control. You know, where else, when all else is out of control, perhaps the only thing I can control is what I do or do not eat, or so a person thinks. This is one thing I can, decide for myself. I think another emotional need is success. One thing I can be successful at is maybe being thin. Maybe I can succeed. One young lady recalls the day. It was actually an event in her life. She can recall the day when she stepped on the scale and she'd lost 2 pounds. And she thought to herself, I have failed in all. So one young lady I was working with failed week in and week out to do some of the things we were talking about. And we come in and talk, and I said, well, what's the deal? You know, why are you not trying to apply some of these things? And she said, well, I find that when something doesn't work, I just quit. I just don't do it. And I said, well, what has your bulimia accomplished for you? Is it working for you? And she said, no. And then she stopped for a minute and she said, you know, that's really insane, isn't it? I just told you that I quit when things don't work. And here I'm totally out of control and it's not working. And I'm not quitting. With that, I'm helpless. And I don't know what to do with that whole situation. So anyway, those are just some common things. As you know, it's a vast area. And we've just kind of skimmed the top tonight. Our time's about out. And I wanted to leave a few minutes at the end just for you to either make some input, some sharing, or ask me some questions at this point. Because it's this kind of topic you can go on and on and on. So I wanted to draw that out. And again, one of the things that I do, of course, I'm an employee of the BSU. I'm a counselor, and I mainly spend most of my time counseling. So I do try to bring in another aspect, and that aspect is the spiritual. But that's not for this meeting here tonight. But we do tie that in with the third area, which is the spiritual type of the thing. But so we look at body, soul, which is mind, will, and emotions, and spirit. So, okay. Any questions or comments, corrections, additions? If not, you get to go home.